Welcome to Brains Matter, a podcast on science, curiosities, and general knowledge. I'm your host, just an ordinary guy. Welcome to the show where brains really do matter. On today's show, I interview Dr. Paul Francis from the Australian National University on Comets. Here with me is Dr. Paul Francis from the Australian National University, so welcome to Brains Matter.
Nice to be here.
So, firstly, could you tell the listeners a little bit about your background?
Well, I grew up in England, studied physics and science at Cambridge, then I worked in the US for a couple of years, the University of Arizona, then came to University of Melbourne for a few years, and then ended up about 10 years ago at the ANU, where I divide my time between teaching physics and astronomy and doing research on galaxies and comets and things like that.
What is a comet?
A comet is a dirty snowball flying through space. So they're basically, as far as we know, no one's actually visited one in person. They are big balls, a mix of organic crud, rocks and ice of various sorts that float through space. And as they float through space, they melt. And as they melt, clouds of gas and dust get blown away, which will give the huge tails that you see dangling behind these things.
Where do most of them come from, I guess?
Damned if we know. this is what first got me interested in these things, is that I was really fascinated ever since I was a kid by a different problem, which is what lies beyond Pluto. That you've got our own solar system, you learn about in all the textbooks, and eight or nine planets, depending on whether you count Pluto. But then what's beyond there? We know there are other stars, but what a lot of people don't realise is just how much empty space there is there. If you do a scale model, let's say you imagine the Earth is the size of a soccer ball, then to that scale, the Moon would be the size of a cricket ball and be about the other side of a fair-sized family room. Mm-hmm. The Sun would be about the size of a room and would be about 3 kilometres away. Pluto would be about 100 kilometres away. But on this scale, you can ask, if you go beyond Pluto, how far would it take to get to the nearest other star, Proxima Centauri? And on the same scale, where Pluto was 100 kilometres away, the next other star would be 4 times around the world.
Wow.
So there is just an enormous amount of empty space. Mm-hmm. And you know, what's out there? We know there are no stars out there, because stars shine and we'd see them, but there could be almost anything else. For example, if you took the Earth and plonked it out there halfway to the nearest star, I wouldn't see it. The only reason you normally see planets is because they reflect the light from the sun.
Sure.
I always use an analogy of being like in the outback. If you imagine you're in an outback at night, sitting around a campfire, and you can see the faces of the person across the campfire from you because it's reflecting the firelight. Mm-hmm. And if you stand up, turn your back at the campfire, you might see where this is someone else's campfire 20 kilometres away, and you might see shadows moving around that. But what's in between? Every now and then you might see a strange shape or hear a strange thump or something, but there could be almost anything out there. Troops of dancing girls, carnivorous kangaroos, drop bears, you name it, and you wouldn't know. And the same applies for the empty space between the planets. There are no really bright stars out there, because we'd see them. There can't be a brick wall, and we wouldn't see anything further away. You could take all the missing odd socks from the Earth or put them out there, or put literally tens of thousands of planets out there, and no one would know. They're too far away to see. And so that's what got me interested in comets originally, because comets are the one thing we know that comes from these empty space. Mm-hmm. Every now and then, typically a few times a year, a comet is seen coming in from beyond Pluto. And typically they come in from beyond Pluto. When they first spotted, they're just like a lump of ice. And as they get closer to the sun, they start warming up. They then start melting and evaporating and blowing off huge clouds of dust. And they swing around the sun. Often they blow up at this point. A fair fraction of comets just disintegrate because of the sheer heat. Mm-hmm. But if they survive, they then swing around, disappear back out again, never to be seen again.
And that's where we see the huge big tails come out with as well.
That's right, when they come close to the sun.
So do the majority of the comets that we notice from here on Earth, are they from around the Kuiper Belt objects? Or?
There are two sorts of comets. There are so-called short-period comets, which means anyone we've seen more than once. Mm. And then the long-period comets, which is actually the vast majority, which only ever come past once. Technically, most of them are in orbits that will bring them back, but these orbits are typically 10 million years long, so maybe some cavemen observed them last time. So you've got comets like the famous one, like Halley's Comet, mm-hmm. which come past every 70-whatever years, and then there are other short-period comets that come past very regularly. And these are believed to come from the Kuiper Belt that you mentioned, which is the belt of icy things of which Pluto is a member. But they're a minority. The vast majority of comets are actually come from much, much further beyond that. It's like saying on the analogy I used before, these short-period comets come from just beyond 100 kilometres away. Mm-hmm. These other ones come out from New York.
Yeah, I guess this is the big quandary. How they formed.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of big quandaries. I mean, the other thing is the comets don't last very long in the close to the solar system. Mm-hmm. They typically only survive a few passages through the solar system before they disintegrate. And basically, if you're walking in the park and you see lots of ice creams in the hands of kids, you know there must be somewhere cold nearby that's storing them. Mm-hmm. Ice creams don't last very long in hot summer. So likewise, there must be somewhere cold that's a reservoir of these things. And even on 10 million year periods, these things can't have survived the age of our solar system. So presumably they formed sometime back the same time the solar system formed 4.6 billion years ago. They must have been transported to somewhere cold, left there securely, and then for some reason they get a death wish, two or three of them every year, and they come in to die horribly near the sun. So these are all things we don't know about. First of all, how did they form in the first place? Did they form in an ice box somewhere? What is this ice box they live in? It's called the Oort cloud, but we don't really know it's there. Mm-hmm. And then why did they suddenly acquire a death wish and come in to visit us?
The Oort cloud you mentioned, why do we think it's primarily from there? Couldn't they form anywhere else in the...
Well,
the universe?
The Oort cloud is, we don't know it's true, this is a theory. Mm-hmm. The observation is that you see the orbits of these things when they're close to the sun. By the time they get out much beyond Saturn's orbit, they become invisible, their tail goes away, we can't see them anymore. So we only see a very small fraction of their orbit, but we can extrapolate that tiny bit of the orbit and work out where they come from. Mm-hmm. And typically they have orbits that carry them out to about a light year away from the Earth, so a quarter of the way to the nearest stars. Mm-hmm. And they seem to come from every direction. Everything else in the solar system lies in a plane called the ecliptic, all the planets, the Kuiper Belt object, the short period comets all live in this plane. But these things don't. They seem to come from any direction, up, down. They're as likely to go forward as backwards. The normal theory is that there must exist a cloud of comets about a light year out that's a sphere or a shell all the way around the solar system. And we've never seen it. We have no way of seeing it. It's far beyond telescope technology. Mm-hmm. But that's the idea. And that somehow the comets got out there. And most of them are just orbiting, so they stay out there. And every now and then one of them changes its orbit, so it kind of dips in to visit us.
That's a big somehow, though, isn't it?
Yes, it is. So the orthodox wisdom, which is not to say it is true, is that they actually formed, the comets are actually leftovers from the formation of the solar system. Mm-hmm. The idea is that when you form the solar system, you start off with large numbers of lumps of rock and ice spinning in a disk around the sun. Rock in the inner parts, ice in the outer bits where it's cooler. And these would have originally been the size of grains of dust, and they would have smashed together until they formed things the size of boulders, and they would have smashed together to form things the size of trucks, and kept on smashing and smashing, until eventually they end up with whopping great things the size of Mars banging into other ones. And eventually this slows down because they've now smashed together so much there are only very few things left, and they're all very big. Mm-hmm. That's where we are now. And there's a big debate over whether the solar system is now stable, or whether there's still going to be more smashing going on, but certainly smashing is now pretty rare. But in the process... a lot of these things would have ended up being scattered into the sun or flung out into deep space. So there would have been, say, an icy lump that came close to a lump that's going to turn into Jupiter. And if it had hit Jupiter, it would have just made Jupiter a bit bigger. Mm-hmm. But instead it came close and would have been pulled by Jupiter's gravity either into an orbit that fell into the sun or into an orbit that got flung out into deep space. So the normal idea is that there were large numbers of icy blocks got flung out into deep space back when the planets were forming. Mm-hmm. And there's... some estimates say there could be up to 10 trillion of these things out there, and they could have more mass than all the planets put together.
Yeah.
No one knows. The big debate is whether it's only 100 billion or 10 trillion. But it's perfectly clear there are probably more of these ice blocks out there than everything else in the solar system put together. Mm-hmm. So then they get out there, and then they stay out there for 4 billion years, and they come in to visit us. And why the hell do they do that? And the conventional wisdom is that it's two things. One is it's actually passing stars. They're so far out, light year out, that the gravity of the sun is very tenuous. Mm-hmm. And so if a star comes past, the stars come past within a light year or so every million years or so.
It affects their gravity.
It'll perturb them a bit and nudge them out of their orbits, and some fraction will get captured by the new star, mm-hmm. and some fraction, a large fraction, will get scattered out of deep space, but a small fraction will...
come plumbing back.
Yes, an orbit that brings them in close. Mm-hmm. So that's the conventional wisdom.
So what range of sizes do we presume most of these comets are?
No one really knows. What you see is not the comet itself. You see what's called the coma, which is the cloud of dust and gas around it. Mm-hmm. And until the 80s, no one actually seen what was in the middle. There was a debate about whether there actually was anything in the middle. Some people thought there would be a single big icy lump in the middle. Some people thought there should be a cloud of boulders of ice. That was resolved in the 80s when Halley's Comet came past, mm-hmm. and the European Space Agency sent a space probe called Giotto past it and actually took photographs of what was in the middle of this huge coma. Mm-hmm. And it turned out it was actually a jet black lump about the shape of a giant peanut, mm-hmm. about 16 kilometres long. So the first puzzle, if it's ice, why is it jet black? They're very, very dark in colour with a faint reddish tinge. And now four or five have now been visited by spacecraft, and they all seem to be very dark, peanut-shaped things a few kilometres in length.
So what is causing that dark colour?
Probably
Is there a high iron content in there somewhere? Or?
Probably they have about the consistency of a pavlova. In the case of black ones, a burnt pavlova. So in the movie Armageddon, Bruce Willis walked on a comet to save us from death. They're probably sunk in. They're probably the same sort of density as polystyrene, and they're made of some combination of water ice, so like loose packed snow most likely, frozen dry ice, carbon dioxide, frozen methane, frozen ethane, also boulders, gravel, and probably all sorts of organic crap. Speaking technically there.
So given that they're this particular average consistency, everyday person sees a block of ice and they put it near a stove and it melts quite quickly. Some of these comets seem to last quite a long time. One would assume that as they go closer to the sun, the heat energy from the sun would just burn them off completely. And you mentioned that does happen occasionally, but
it does happen. But these things are actually quite big. I mean, you just imagine if you take a frozen drink bottle, it can last all day. If you take a frozen turkey, it'll last maybe a couple of days before it defrosts. And the Russian scientists back in the 60s brought a frozen mammoth out, and that took best part of a month or so. Now you've got to imagine something that's frozen and is 10 kilometers across, and you can see the time it will take to defrost is quite long. And these things whip around the sun pretty fast. They spend most of the time a long way out. The actual time when they're close to the sun might only be a month or so. And so these things are probably big enough that they can not fully melt in that time. I mean, Halley's Comet's now been going past every 70-something years since at least Roman times. And it is getting fainter each time. It probably is steadily losing all its ices. And so it was pretty pathetic last time it went past. And eventually it'll probably lose all the ice. That's probably why it's black now, that it's lost most of its ices, and what you're left behind is the organic crud and the rocks. Probably got a sort of rather wrinkly skin like an apple that's been out in the sun too long. And it's steadily losing the ice. Probably a bit of ice still protected inside this wrinkly skin, but if it keeps on going past and going past, eventually it'll lose all the volatiles. And probably that's when it turns, it disintegrates at that point. There's nothing holding it together anymore. And there's a cloud of gravel floating through space. And that's believed to be what meteorite showers are.
Okay.
And in fact, several meteorite showers coincide with the orbits of historical comets. So, you know, certain times of the year you get lots of meteorites. That's probably when we're passing through was a comet and it ran out of volatile gases.
Running through its
500 years ago,
running through its tail. Speaking of the composition of comets and so on, I've read some discussion a while ago about the consistency of objects within the solar system that are distant. For example, Pluto, and one I forgot where it was that I was reading it. One discussion I read was that if Pluto was actually moving towards the sun, it would be classified as a comet.
Yes. I mean, Pluto is made of ice primarily, and so if it came close to the sun, it might well acquire a tail. It might actually be too big. I mean, Pluto's got quite a substantial gravity, so the gravity may be enough to stop the tail forming. Then all the gas would bubble out, but then stay as an atmosphere around Pluto rather than drifting out into space. But in principle, something like Pluto comes past, it would be the mother of all comets.
Is there a particular limit to what we consider a comet to be?
Most comets are pretty small. The vast majority of comets are only like 10 or 50 metres across. Those ones generally only seen when they come very, very close to the sun. They're actually seen by a spacecraft called SOHO that looks at the sun. And you see dozens of these things a year falling into the sun. The ones that we normally see from Earth are typically a few kilometres across. And in principle, there are bigger ones. The biggest one, whose size of the thing in the middle has ever been measured, was about 35 kilometres across. Which is still a lot smaller than Pluto, which is like 2,000 kilometres across. But there are almost certainly much bigger ones out there, and there are certainly accounts in history of much brighter comets. We have not had any really good comets for a
long while.
Well, we had Comet McNaught last year, which was pretty spectacular.
Yeah, and photos of that on my website for those listeners who want to have a look at it.
And that was pretty spectacular if you got a chance to see it down here in the south. But even so, there are reports, like in the 19th century, there was one year when there were three comets that went through, each of which was so bright it could be seen by daylight. And it actually caused panic in the streets of Paris. And we haven't had one in any of those for over 150 years, so we're well overdue, because these things typically go past every century or so. They're unpredictable, because you can't see them coming from out beyond Pluto. And this is probably one with maybe 50 or 70 kilometre size nucleus. And almost certainly there are ones out there with 100 kilometre, 200 kilometre, 300 kilometre nuclei, but they might only come past every 1,000 years or so. So maybe tomorrow someone will announce they've seen one and we're going to get a comet that's so bright it'll outshine the full moon.
And speaking of movies that we were talking about before, every now and again we hear of something from the press where they say, oh, there's been a comet that's just gone past and we didn't notice it until the very last minute. How is it that something like that can happen? I know that the sky is as Douglas Adams says, that
really, really big,
and we can't look in every direction all the time. But you would sort of, you would think there's enough things looking out there that that pick up the majority of things that could be coming towards us.
It's a question of size. Most things that come close to us are actually not comets, they're asteroids. Mm-hmm. So they're lumps of rock rather than lumps of ice. Otherwise, they're very similar. Mm-hmm. And basically, it depends how big they are. The really big asteroids are like 1,000 kilometres across, and we know all of those, unless there are some out of the Oort cloud, which we haven't seen. But all the ones that are close enough don't give us much risk, we've mapped centuries ago. Mm-hmm. The ones that are 100 kilometres across have been mapped 30 or 40 years ago. People are currently working on mapping the ones that are, you know, a few kilometres in size, mm-hmm. and estimates are we probably found about 70 or 80% of those. Trouble is that we can only see them when they come quite close to the Earth. Mm-hmm. If you take something 5 kilometres across and put it on the other side of the Sun or halfway to Mars, it's going to be too faint to see with current telescopes, mm-hmm. Unless we get lucky. But when they come close, we can spot them. So basically what you do is you survey the sky all around the Earth. As the Earth goes around the Sun, hopefully over time you start picking up everything that's going to be a risk to us, will at some point come close to the Earth, hopefully not too close, and we'll map it. So at the moment, probably most of the new dinosaur killers have been mapped. Mm-hmm. The continent busters, they probably mapped 70 or 80% of them. The ones that are now worry are the few hundred metre to a kilometre sized ones. These ones, we can only see them if they're really close. So looking at a lump of rock that's a kilometre aside, that's near a million miles away, and that's actually quite hard to spot. We are picking up some of them, but especially in the southern hemisphere, there are quite a few that haven't been seen yet.
So what is the, probably putting a span in the works, a lot of Hollywood producers out there, but what's the probability of something like that coming into our atmosphere?
Well, the Earth's been hit by small ones all the time. Mm. There was, I think it was a week or two ago, that they a schoolboy in Germany was hit by a meteorite.
Ouch.
It's only the second person in recorded history who's actually been hurt by a meteorite. Mm. There was a lady in America in the 1950s, a meteorite came through the roof, destroyed her TV, ricocheted off, bounced off her arm, and then left a hole in the floor of her couch. She actually lived opposite the Comet Drive-In Theatre, which is either spooky or totally irrelevant, depending on your point of view. But and this guy in Germany just a couple of weeks ago was hit by it. But I mean, these are ones that are probably the size of, you know, a soccer ball when they enter the atmosphere, and the size of a pea by the time they hit the people at the bottom.
Yeah.
But big ones do land. The last big one that landed in Siberia in 1908, the Stony Tunguska River. That was probably 50 to 100 metres across, and it destroyed several hundred square kilometres of pine forest. Luckily, no one was living in. Mm-hmm. But ones that big probably hit every 100 years or so, and the vast majority land in the ocean or the desert, because most of the Earth is still ocean and desert. Mm-hmm. The real worry for those is that someone's ballistic missile warning system will pick them up and think it's an incoming American or Chinese or Russian ballistic missile. And that happened about 5 times during the Cold War. Okay. That incoming asteroids were mistaken by American or Russian early warning systems as potential, nearly triggered atomic war.
So much for military intelligence, eh?
Yeah, so these ones, you know, they can destroy 100 square kilometres, and most of the Earth is still sparsely inhabited. Mm. But if one landed on New York or Tokyo, it could be very nasty, and these things are probably once a century. Mm-hmm. Then you get the bigger ones, which you could knock out, you know, 1,000 square kilometres, say, and these are going to be rarer, so that might be once every few thousand years. Mm. And then you get the ones that like wipe out the dinosaurs, the really big ones, and those are every few million years. Mm. And there's a debate about whether it's 7 million or 10 million. And it's not really, it's not as if they come every 7 million years and, oh, we had one 2 million years ago, we're going to save for the next 5. It's a random process. You could get 3 in a row and then nothing for the next 25 million years.
Sure. And going to a totally different topic, you're also interested in black holes, and I was reading on your website, you had a mention of pink black holes. What are pink black holes?
Yes, I have to carefully call them pink black holes rather than pink holes. When I called them that, I found I was getting linked from large numbers of pornography websites. So I won't go there. Of course, if a black hole really is black and space is black, you don't see it. Mm. So the vast majority of black holes out there, we don't see. They're black on black, and that's a bit of a challenge.
Because there's no light there.
Yes. Mm. So the normal way you see black holes in space is if they're eating something. Mm. So you're not actually seeing the black hole itself.
From the X-rays.
You're seeing the stuff that's being torn to pieces.
Yeah.
At the time I was studying quasars, our quasars are thought to be really massive black holes, a few, you know, maybe 10 to 100 million times the mass of the Sun. That live in the middle of galaxies, and they devour nearby gas clouds and stars, tore them to pieces, and this gas swirls around the throat, and as it swirls around the throat and falls, it gets really hot, typically 30,000 degrees, mm-hmm. and if you heat something up to 30,000 degrees, it glows with a blue light. Mm-hmm. So the way you find quasars, you look for blue dots. We had been searching for quasars a different way, using radio telescopes, particularly the Parkes radio telescope, mm-hmm. and we're finding quasars. The trouble was that our quasars, when we looked at the colours, were not blue. They were, well, some of them were blue, but some of them were horrible shade of brown or yellow, and some of them are actually pink. And this made no sense to us then, and makes no sense to us now.
Does that indicate just a different temperature or something totally?
No, it's not a different temperature. The spectrum is actually wrong for it to be that. We don't know what it is. Our best guess, to begin with, we thought there might be blue, but hidden behind a dust cloud. Mm-hmm. Just like when you look at the sun through a sunset, dust in the atmosphere makes it appear red.
Yeah.
It could be that we're looking at a blue quasar through a cloud of interstellar or intergalactic dust, and that was making it appear red. But the exact sort of redness is wrong. That would give it a sort of browny, orangey-red colour, just like a sunset.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas these are more like a sort of purple colour.
Mm-hmm.
And so that turns out didn't work. So our next guess is that we're actually has a natural radio transmitter. The way a radio transmitter works is you get a long wire and you jiggle electrons up and down by applying a voltage to it,
mm-hmm.
and that generates radio waves. So what we've got here is that the black hole is in some way accelerating beams of probably electrons and causing them to jiggle. Only they're jiggling much faster than they do in a radio transmitter. In a radio transmitter, they jiggle at slow speeds, so you get radio waves. These ones are jiggling a million times faster, so instead of radio waves, you get pink light.
Yeah.
But quite why it should cause them to jiggle at these speeds, or why it should accelerate in the first place, we to this day have no idea.
Okay, so that's an open question for further research.
Unfortunately so.
And finally, I want to finish up on some of the novel ways that you teach your students in your classes. I was reading that you have adventure games.
Yes. A number of years ago, I was really worried about the fact that many students tend to see science as a whole bunch of equations and facts to learn.
How could they ever think that? Science is exciting.
I can't imagine why, no. Hopefully no one listening to these podcasts will be thinking that.
They all love science.
But I was thinking, is there some way... I mean, there are lots of surveys that show that typical science students think that science is boring, antisocial, and consists mostly of memorisation. And that's not what being a research scientist is at all like.
Mm-hmm.
Research scientists, you don't know the answer, because you know the answer, you're not worth researching it. Mm-hmm. So everything's uncertain. You can't look up the answer in the back of the textbook. It's very sociable. Almost all research is done in teams. And you go to conferences and try and get your rival teams drunk to try and find out what they're... get them to spill the beans on what they're currently working at. And it's very exciting and it's very creative. You're always dreaming up weird and wonderful ideas and then watch them go down in flames when you take the data. And so I was trying desperately to think of some way in which I could get over the sense of creativeness and social nature of science. Astronomy is pretty good for this because it's a very broad and shallow subject, because we don't sort of all about anything. Which is fine, because we're insignificant life forms living on a speck of dust around a boring planet in the middle of nowhere. Why should we expect to know anything about anything? But it means that you can explain almost any problem in astronomy to the level where we get to, I don't know the answer to this, in about 10 minutes. Like, what's the universe made of? We don't know. Where did it come from? We don't know. Where do comets come from? We don't know. So what I try and do is I get the students to debate these things. So one thing I do is use role-playing games in class, whereas instead of presenting a theory of where comets come from, I would give the students clues. And each student would divide themselves into groups of three, and each student would have a clue, a one-page briefing paper giving them some information. And what they then have to do is wander around the classroom and talk to the other students and exchange clues. And I put lots of red herrings in there, because one of the skills they've got to learn is everything in here is true, but none of it is relevant. Mm-hmm. They have to separate the important from the irrelevant stuff. And then at the end I say that if you can actually figure out a complete theory of where comets come from, you come down the front and present it to your classmates. You don't get the answer right, just as in the real world, all that matters is persuading them that you're right. It can be as stupid as you like, and if you can pull the wool over their eyes, you get the prize. I typically give them glow-in-the-dark stars or chocolates or something. And it works really well, they have a great time. I once had the security guards come in and try and close me down because I thought there was a riot was going on in my class. But by all indications, the students learn a lot more than they do in traditional lectures. And more recently, I've been trying things like adventure games with the same sort of goal. So I wrote an adventure game where you... I thought that...
It's kind of like Zork from the 80s.
Exactly. That was deliberate. I was trying to think about... The closest analogue to science is actually the murder mystery, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that students are normally very happy to deal with you, being very sceptical when it's in the context of Agatha Christie and Sherlock Holmes. Never trust anyone, everyone's lying to you.
Yep.
But somehow that whole critical facility turns off when they get to science, and we always get complaints, why are you such a sceptic? You never believe anything. You don't believe in my latest fad diet, whatever it might be. And so I thought, wouldn't it be nice if we could make it into a murder mystery, where you've got clues and some people are lying to you. In this case, it's the world universe that's lying to you rather than people, generally. And I thought, I'd have to do this computer game. So I tried to dig out. I didn't play computer games. And so I dug into the computer game, tried to work out if there are any murder mystery ones. It seemed that most current games are involved more like running around blowing things up or simulating social lives or something like that. But there was a genre of these games back in the 80s, which were these adventure games,
mm-hmm.
Of which Zork is the most famous.
Yeah.
And it turned out there's now a huge amateur community that writes these things. They no longer have commercial value. but they're written languages. So I wrote one just as an experiment for my students. So you play the role of a young astronomer, and you've just been appointed to a job at prestigious Mount Stromlo Observatory, and you're sitting at your desk wondering, what do I do now? And so you have to wander around the room and talk to your colleagues and read papers, read your email, go to seminars and colloquia and try and pick up clues. And eventually, if you do this enough, you'll start finding some clues, some possible mysteries to solve. And then you can apply for telescope time, and if you put the right keywords in your application, you get telescope time, then you go to telescope and observe stuff and get data in. And over time, you can hopefully build up a theory, and if you come up with anything interesting, you get marks, and it tells you how many marks you've got. You're now on level 3, you've just got three interesting things, and the students use as an assignment for the students.
That sounds really good. Are you just like a real academic?
Yes, I mean, actually it was a disaster when I used it in class, that particular exercise, because you had to read the manual, and students these days are clearly so used to computer games that you don't read the manual. The manual was only one page long, wasn't very big, but 80% of the class tried to use it without reading the manual, and the people are also very much used to point and click. Mm-hmm. They have to point and click, and the idea of having to actually type words into something. I didn't want to point and click because that becomes an exercise in... there are four buttons. I tried another game a few years earlier where you had to rescue Luke Skywalker from orbit, and it was designed to teach how orbits work, so you had to steer your spacecraft like an arcade game into a little Java applet. And that was... when I asked students how they solved it at the end, 70% said, well, you realise you had to work with gravity rather than against it, and you had to raise your orbit, which is what I was hoping for. But 30%, when I asked them how they solved it, they said, well, you press the green button 4 times, then you wait 5 seconds, then you press the red button twice, then you pause for 2 seconds, then you press the yellow button twice. And it was clear they'd solved the entire thing purely by trial and error with no understanding of the physics. And so I wanted to avoid that. With a point-and-click interface, you tend to get a bit more of trial and error. That button didn't work. Let's try this one now. But unfortunately, I think this would have worked till I tried the same exercise 20 years ago, but nowadays students are deeply well into graphical user interfaces, and it didn't work. So I'm now working on a graphical user interface version.
I quite enjoyed Zork and those sorts of things. Maybe I'm showing my age there.
My age too.
On that note, Dr. Paul Francis, I'd like to thank you very much for your time on Brains Matter today.
It's been a pleasure.
I'll leave you with a quote from Michael Pritchard. You don't stop laughing because you grow old. You grow old because you stop laughing. Bye for now. Thanks for listening to the show. You can check out the Brains Matter website at www.brainsmatter.com. That's www.brainsmatter.com. And you can find all the other episodes of the show there. Just click on the podcast link on the right-hand side. You can listen to the episodes from your browser by choosing Flash Player from the links and selecting whichever episode you want to hear from within the player. There's also other information on the site, such as links to articles and news, subscription details, both via iTunes and manually, and voting information. If you have any comments or suggestions, you can leave an entry on this episode's show notes on the webpage, or you can send me an email. All my contact information can be found on the site. The theme music Future is performed by Cut Copy and comes courtesy of Glenn Gertz from Modular Records. I hope you enjoyed the show. Bye for now.